We're spending most of today's show on the national controversy over voter ID laws and other measures enacted in states which could affect turnout in the 2012 election. The measures have been enacted almost entirely by Republican lawmakers and governors who say they're needed to prevent voter fraud, and they're opposed by Democrats who argue they'll disenfranchise many poor and minority voters. Our next guest is Nate Persily. He's the Charles Keller Beekman Professor of Law and Political Science at Columbia University. His research and writing focuses on voting and election law. Persily told me that the push for voter ID legislation gained momentum after fictitious names were discovered on voter registration applications gathered by the group ACORN, which Republicans said showed widespread fraud and election tampering by Democratic supporters. We recorded our interview yesterday. What, if anything, did the ACORN controversy prove about the vulnerability of the election system to tampering?
The ACORN controversy focused on voter registration fraud, which is very different than election fraud. And so, as is often the case when you outsource the registration of voters to third-party groups, you get people who are paid, say, by the name that they number of names they bring in. And so then we had examples of someone putting down the full list of the Dallas Cowboys, people registering Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. But of course, these are not going to be people who show up on election day. But it got a lot of press. And so then it was seen as in the 2008 election, it was called sort of a big indicator of election fraud. But from voter registration fraud, it takes a pretty big leap to then talk about voter impersonation fraud, which is the kind of fraud that is prevented by a voter ID law. And voter impersonation fraud is where someone shows up at the polling place trying to be someone else.
Right. And just to complete this thought, when someone registers a phony name on a voter registration application, I mean, you can put anything. Is there any evidence that this resulted in fraudulent actual registrations, that is to say, names on voter registration rolls for non-existent people?
Well, there are names on voter registration rolls for non-existent people, but they don't vote. And more to the point, there are huge inaccuracies in the voting rolls. There are people who move. There are people who die. There are all kinds of false names that are on the voter registration rolls. We don't do what most countries do, which is to sort of leave the burden of registration with the government. Instead, we outsource it to the parties, outside groups, and then also to individuals on their own initiative to register to vote. As a result, it's not uncommon to see 10% of the names on a voter registration list be for people who could not vote in that jurisdiction legally, but they don't show up to vote if they are, you know, obviously dead or Mickey Mouse or names that were incorrectly put on by someone who is just gathering names.
Okay. So let's talk about the kind of voter fraud that a voter ID law would be aimed at preventing. If there are names on voter rolls for non-existent people and they're reasonable sounding names, John Simpson, whatever, could someone walk in and say, I'm John Simpson, and if there's no voter ID requirement, cast a ballot? Does this happen?
Yes, it happens. But the size of the problem is as I've described it, passing a voter ID law in order to get at that scale of a problem is like killing a fly with a bazooka. There's a lot of collateral damage, and that it is true that we will have non-citizens voting. We will have ineligible felons that will vote. We will have people who will vote sometimes in the name of another. But we're talking about isolated instances. And the reason is, if you're trying to throw an election, if you're trying to rig an election, voter impersonation fraud is an extremely inefficient way to do so. And that's because in order to actually get enough people to affect the outcome, you'd have to have hordes of people going from one polling place to the next impersonating voters. And that's a risky legal maneuver to play. And more importantly, there are better ways to rig an election. And the area where we do see fraud in American elections from looking at, say, prosecutions is absentee ballot fraud. When you take the act of voting outside of public view and it's outside the polling place, that's where we actually see fraud. And these voter ID laws do nothing to combat that kind of fraud. If anything, many of the voter ID states have actually shifted a lot of these voters into the absentee ballot pool where they're going to be more susceptible to fraud.
Just to be clear about this, is there any empirical data on how common voter impersonation is?
It is very rare. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of times in an election, but we're not talking about, hundreds of thousands.
We're talking about hundreds in hundreds in the country. Out of tens of millions.
Okay. Right. Okay. And so, you know, it happens just, as I said, like all kinds of other things that happen that lead to disorganization on election day.
Nate Persily is a professor of law and political science at Columbia University. His research and writing focuses on voting and election law. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. We're spending most of today's show on the controversy over voter ID laws and other measures enacted in states which could affect turnout in the 2012 election. The measures have been enacted almost entirely by Republicans, who say they'll prevent vote tampering and fraud, and they're opposed by Democrats, who argue they'll disenfranchise many poor and minority voters. We're speaking with Columbia University law and political science professor Nate Persily, whose research focuses on voting and election law. Now, what about the simple point made by advocates of these laws that everybody needs an ID for everything these days? You're asked for IDs at airports, to get into office buildings, to make a bank withdrawal. That it's fairly common, and in fact common in other countries, to ask for an ID when you vote.
That's true. Just to correct the record on one thing, which is that you do not actually need a photo ID in order to get on an airplane, which is the most ubiquitous example that's used. If you don't have your photo ID, you're simply subject to greater screening in order to get on an airplane. But it's certainly the case that, you know, having an ID is part of life, and that it is true. If you look at the Washington Post ABC poll from the last week, 75% of Americans support photo ID laws. And as you said, it is true that almost every country in the world requires a photo ID in order to vote. All of those countries, however, produce a national ID card. We don't have a national ID card in the U.S. We rely, again, on individuals to get these IDs, usually from Department of Motor Vehicles or maybe through, say, a passport. And so it is true that it is popular. It is also not brain surgery or rocket science to get these, but we know that there are specific biases as to who has and who doesn't have ID, and for some people, it is going to be very difficult. People who don't have a birth certificate and people who have difficulty getting to the areas where they would need to get the government-issued photo ID.
You mentioned that absentee ballots are a better way to steal votes than impersonating voters going into a polling place. Why?
Well, you can do fraud at the wholesale instead of the retail level this way. And what that means is a group of political operatives can go into, say, a nursing home, fill out all the absentee ballots for the people there and mail them in. And we have substantial numbers of examples of that, even in New York, where I'm calling you from. We have sort of throughout history, if you look at the places where we've had prosecutions for fraud, and there's currently one underway in Massachusetts, it's almost always because of absentee ballot fraud. It's more efficient. You can get more votes cast if you do it that way, and you're less subject to scrutiny because the people who would see you in the polling place can't see you do it outside of public view when you're doing it at your home. You could also coerce voters more easily with absentee ballots than you can in the polling place when everybody would see what you're doing.
Now, one of the things that critics of the voter ID laws have said is that there is clearly a disparate impact, that it impacts the poor and minorities disproportionately, and of course that means that's more likely to affect Democratic turnout. Are they right?
Well, we don't know for sure whether that's going to be true. It is true if you look at the non-ID population that it is overrepresented among racial minorities, and that's been shown in Texas and Pennsylvania and elsewhere. But again, some of those people would not have voted anyway, and so it's difficult empirically to say what share of the likely voter population would not vote as a result of a voter ID law. Nevertheless, if what we're trying to answer is whether this law has a disparate impact in that it's going to maybe deter minority voters at a greater rate than, say, non-minority voters, then yes, I think that you can see that effect. The partisan effects, it's really hard to figure out. In Indiana, they had a voter ID law in effect when Barack Obama won that state in the 2008 election, and black turnout actually went up. It's, you know, of course, the fact that black turnout went up had a lot to do with him being on the ballot. And so maybe if there hadn't been a voter ID law, that we would have had a greater number of African Americans that were turning out in that race anyway. But it's very difficult to say ex ante what the partisan and racial disparate impact is going to be.
Right. If we can't determine a partisan impact of the law, we can certainly see partisan differences in origin and support, can't we? I mean, these laws are being enacted by Republicans and opposed by Democrats pretty much uniformly, right?
That's right. The only state that's enacted a more restrictive law that's a Democratic state is Rhode Island. But even that law, which is a photo ID law, allows for sort of an escape hatch for voters who don't have photo ID on the day of the election. They can simply sign an affidavit saying they are who they say they are.
Now, the Supreme Court took on this issue in 2008, I believe, right? They looked at the Indiana law, found it constitutional. What questions did that answer definitively? What questions does it leave unanswered?
The case Crawford versus Marion County that the Supreme Court decided, and it was a 6-3 decision, upheld voter ID laws on their face, meaning that they do not violate the constitutionally guaranteed right to vote found in the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. And what I mean by that is that voter ID laws are not per se unconstitutional. They are not by themselves subject to sort of heightened scrutiny that you have to sort of justify every disenfranchised individual as a result of a voter ID law. Instead, what the court said is you can bring as-applied challenges. And so if you can find a group of people who are particularly affected by these ID laws, that those folks could have their own lawsuit that they could bring. And if it is the case that these laws are motivated by discriminatory intent, for example, trying to deprive African Americans and Hispanics of the right to vote, then they are subject to the same kind of constitutional restrictions as other laws that might be racially motivated. But on their face, just because a state passes a photo ID law does not make it unconstitutional.
All right. And the cases that have been brought challenging them, the one in Pennsylvania is a case in the state court, right?
That's right. And there's several state court challenges in different states. Wisconsin has state and federal challenges. We have cases brought under the Voting Rights Act, both Section 5, which applies to most of the states in the South, and potentially under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which applies nationwide. And those cases are focusing on the racially disparate impact. And so a lot of these laws, which were passed over the last 3 or 4 years, are now being held up in court, in one court or another, and may not be in force for the 2012 election.
We're speaking with Nate Persily. He's a professor of law and political science at Columbia University. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Nate Persily. He's a professor of law and political science at Columbia University. He studies voting and election law across the country. Now, we've seen a lot of changes in recent years in voting law, which is aimed at expanding opportunities to vote. You want to just describe some of the ways voting has changed?
Well, in the last election, about a quarter of Americans cast their votes earlier absentee. And so we are slowly moving to a electoral system which is very different than the way we've sort of conceived it in our civics textbooks, where we have this sort of celebratory day on a Tuesday where everybody votes at once. Instead, we've been having elections that last for about a month before the election and culminate on election day. And so it's likely that roughly a third or more of Americans will cast their votes earlier absentee this time. And sooner, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, we may be talking about a majority of Americans casting their votes by mail or earlier absentee. And what states have done this time around is many of them have constricted the early voting period. And so we saw in the 2008 election how many people in Florida, for example, took advantage of the early voting period where they could go to a polling place which was open for 2 weeks prior to Election Day. And that had the advantage of not forcing people to choose between, say, working on a Tuesday and turning out to vote. And different groups of people were voting early than maybe turned out on Election Day. And what these states have done is constricted the number of days that the early voting period is open for.
Do you see any disadvantage in allowing people to vote I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks earlier. I mean, it, you know, the idea that, that the election is, you know, sampling the nation's preference on election day.
Well, there is a concern that some event may happen between the time one casts a ballot and the day of the election so that one's preferences might have changed. But that's also – that's going to be true with the absentee ballot pool as well. But I think that that's one concern. There's also a concern about monitoring these election polling places, these early election – early voting polling places. So the campaigns sometimes complain about – early voting because it requires for them to have sort of poll workers looking or people from the campaign looking over the shoulders of poll workers for the 2 weeks prior to Election Day, which is the most resource-intensive, important time of a campaign. And now a lot of them are being sort of outsourced to look over the shoulders of poll workers.
Now, as with the case with the voter ID laws, we see a clear partisan divide in these attempts to restrict early voting or absentee voting, don't we?
Yes, we do. So you see about, I think, about 5 states who've passed restrictions on early voting: Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, West Virginia, Ohio, I think. And those states have constricted the early voting period or otherwise regulated absentee ballots in a particular way.
In Ohio, you actually see some counties in which it's more restricted than others, and it appears that because of the way local election boards and the way the state government is set up, the heavily Democratic areas are finding restricted early voting hours, some of the Republican ones not so.
Well, we'll wait and see what happens on Election Day with this. We have lawsuits, as is always the case, filed in a lot of these areas. Florida's law has not been given permission because they are under the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. We have lawsuits that the Obama campaign team has brought in Ohio. And as we were discussing earlier, one of the challenges is when you have disparate or different enforcement of these laws between counties, you run into the same criticisms that we ran into in Bush versus Gore in the 2000 election, where we had punch card ballots in some areas and we had optical scan technology and others for counting votes. If it turns out that, you know, your absentee ballot has a greater chance of being counted in one county than another, that poses a constitutional problem.
You know, so many of our rules about voting are debated on, you know, merits of ballot security and access. But the rules are actually made by partisans, by elected officials who are active Republicans or Democrats in state legislatures, in governor's chairs, and also in county election boards, which are often elective. And it just raises questions about the motives of some of these moves. And I'm wondering, if we made you king for a day, what's one change you would make in the way we vote?
Well, I would have national rules of ballot design, voter registration, and eligibility. Now, that is truly only if I were king could I do that, because that's not something that either this Congress and president would be willing to put into effect, or that maybe even the courts would allow. But the big problem in the United States is our decentralization of election authority. And if we had a single ballot for federal races and single rules of eligibility for federal races, and for that matter, access requirements, whether it's voter ID or something else, that I think would go a long way towards solving a lot of these problems. As I said, most countries in the world do that. They don't have the level of decentralization, and they don't have novices, untrained volunteers, being the point of contact for the democracy. And we have sort of the perfect storm of election dysfunction in the U.S., where we have relatively untrained people who are working the polling places, as much as they're doing the yeoman's work for our democracy, and we should thank them. They were still relatively untrained. We have partisans in charge of the operation of the democracy, usually at the state and then also at the county level. And then we have huge decentralization, which then leads to the quality of democracy really varying on the basis of where you live. And those three factors are never in combination in any other country. But we have all three here in the U.S.
And somehow we get it right most of the time, don't we?
Well, that's because most of our elections are never close. And so that is what's known as the election administrator's prayer, which is, God, whatever happens, please do not let it be close. Because once it's close, then every problem in the democracy comes out. And we saw that in 2000, and we've seen that in recounts in things like Minnesota with their Senate recount. So we focused, for example, on punch card ballots in the 2000 presidential election. But what so the close look at the ballots there revealed was not only did they have problems with the election technology, they had problems with the way the ballots were designed. They had problems with the absentee ballot pool, both how it was the provision of absentee ballots as well as how they were counted. They had problems with the list, the voter registration list, where people – there was an over-inclusive felon list so that people who had names who matched people who were on the felon list were also prevented from voting. So there were all kinds of problems that came out there, but you only – see those problems when you do an autopsy on an election during a recount. And we don't usually see them because most of the time elections are won going away because, you know, most of the parts of the U.S. are not competitive between the Democrats and Republicans.
You know, you're here because you're independent. You look at evidence. You don't have any partisan connections. But a lot of people look at the fact that the voter ID laws and the attempts to restrict expanded voting opportunities are being enacted by Republican lawmakers opposed by Democrats. Is it going too far to say that this is a campaign by Republicans to depress Democratic turnout in 2012?
Well, I think that a lot of Republicans and Democrats believe this, in that they look at this this movement for voter ID laws and ask the question, well, why has it happened now? There's been no increase in the number of voter impersonation fraud cases in recent years. So what is really behind this? And I think that the partisan valence of these voter ID laws occurs both because Republicans see it as helping them. And John Fund, who is one of the sort of progenitors of this movement, had written for the Wall Street Journal, admitted this past week that it is not surprising that Republicans would want to have voter ID laws. And the head of the GOP in Pennsylvania said exactly that the voter ID law will help the Republicans win there. And Democrats as well, you know, look at this and say this is an attempt to inhibit Democratic participation. I tend to think that the effects of these laws will not be as great as the critics think or that the proponents hope for. And while I do think there is partisan motivation behind these laws, as is unfortunately true with all election laws that are being passed these days, that it probably will not have the partisan effect that everyone is expecting. But in some areas, it could make a difference. And as I said, the difference that I'm looking at and that I'm very concerned about is the kind of disorder that it's going to create in the polling place. Because the situation that you're going to have in this election is you are going to have some poll workers who look at a voter and say, well, this is someone I don't recognize. I'm going to ask them for an ID, and the voter for the first time in his or her life is going to be asked for an ID and told that they can't vote a regular ballot. They may be told incorrectly that they shouldn't be voting at all, or they may be given a provisional ballot. And the more that happens, the longer the lines, the greater the disorder, the greater the possibility for real discontentment in the polling place and disorder.
Well, Nate, personally, thanks so much for your insights and thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nate Persily is a professor of law and political science at Columbia University. His research and writing focus on voting and election law.